You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Today, as you probably gather, is to do with Aborigines and their land. And we wanted to ask the children who were the first people who lived in the Adelaide area. One story of Tjibulki tells of his chasing an emu across the plains. He was hunting this emu. He became tired and sat down to rest. And he saw his nephew, whose name is Kultui. He was hunting the same emu. Now, in the law of the tribe, that wasn't allowed. If you were hunting a particular emu, somebody else couldn't chase the same emu, apparently. However, Tjibulki forgave his nephew on condition that he provided some of the emu meat to him. However, Kulutui's half-brothers were jealous of him, and they realised that he had actually broken the law. And so while he was cooking the emu over his campfire, they crept up and speared him. So Tjibulki was very much upset by all this. He found out about this, and he, in turn, to remedy that, speared his two nephews. So it's a fairly drastic tat for tat there. But so Tjibulki carried Kultui's body to be, there was a smoking ceremony, and he first went to a place called Tulukutenga. We know that as Kingston Park, and that's the spot on the beach just south of Brighton, where there was a spring, and the tears that Tjibulki wept over the death of his nephew started that spring. Now, interestingly enough, that monument has a very strong connection to this church, because it was created by John Dowie, who was a member of this church up until he died a few years ago. He's also the artist who painted that painting up there. He has many other statues around town, including the three rivers in Victoria Square. Anyway, that's an aside. So Tjibulki then carried the body down along the coast through places like Hallett's Cove, Christie's Beach, Port Nalunga, Aldinga, right down the coast. And where he stopped, he cried more tears and more springs sprang up. This was a lesson to the Kaurna people to maintain their connection to the country. The springs, of course, provide drinking water for the tribe, and they're very important to their life and culture. So his journey tells his people about respecting the lives of birds and animals and the importance of water and the land. Protecting country is very important to our lives and to the lives of those who come after us. Thank you.
My address today is, I think as Peter said earlier, caring for the earth. Now, if you were here earlier this year, you might have heard my other address, which was connection with the earth. And so it's a follow-on from that particular service that I held. But it came originally from a member of a senior minister of All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Her name is the Reverend Dr. Kendall Gibbons. And she talked about, in an article, primal reverence. And it's from that article that I have developed what I have spoken about earlier and will speak about today. You stand at the shore, with the waves beating out their rhythmic crash and the water rushing almost to your feet, seeing nothing but a thin line of horizon where sea and sky meet. The distances suggest infinity, the ocean's unfathomable depth and power, its ceaseless primordial force and mystery. The air, too, moves in a huge current, and the soaring gulls catch light on the back of their wings. Something within us unlatches and expands in that immensity, catching some hint of our finitude. The oneness of all life emerging from the sea's embrace eons ago. The sovereign beauty and freedom of so much overwhelming space and light and sound. These are her words. She also says, the primal experience of reverence in and for the natural world precedes theology of any variety. And that just gives me so much hope, which is why I'm talking about it now. Last time I talked about my experiences in Broken Hill, which is where I was born, and I lived until I was 11 years of age. Now I want to talk about Peter's and my experiences living in the Clare Valley, a very different part of the world, but also very, very beautiful, and somewhere which has given us many wonderful experiences, not only in touch with the land, but also with the people that we have met in that valley. We've lived there since 2005. 32 acres of gum trees, feral lavender, which is very, very fire prone, and Australian plants. We designed our home. It's highly energy efficient. It's a lovely home, isn't it, Margaret? Some of you have visited us there. I wish we were going to be there longer because I'd love to say, please come, we love visitors. But we'll be moving in 3 or 4 weeks' time. So it's highly energy efficient. It has water tanks with a capacity of 132,000 litres. Peter works extremely hard on the property. The lavender has to be slashed. Fire breaks have to be made so that the house is safe from fires. In the last 2 or 3 years, he's done some wonderful landscaping, absolutely gorgeous. And of course, he cuts wood because we have fire heaters. There is an amazing animal life in that area. I sit on our veranda. I watch kangaroos with their joeys. Our mother kangaroos are just like us, really. Mothers like me. I watched the little joey dash up the hill in a big circle and come back to his mother, and then dash up the hill again and come back to his mother. And I think mother just sort of leans down and says, I think that's enough now, dear. Just eat some grass for a while, will you? Yes. I often see skinks. They scurry around near us on the veranda, and we put water out for them in the summer because there isn't enough for them. We see lizards, stumpy tails, who hide underneath parts of the veranda where they can. A frilled neck who comes scurrying. They're very odd looking little arrangements. They sort of run with their tails stuck up high and their heads stuck up high and little skinny legs, and they run, and then if it's a summer day, they'll hop up onto a stone and they'll sit there and they'll bask in the sun for a while, and then they'll hop down and they'll scurry away. And good fun to watch. As you can see, I spend a lot of time just sitting watching some of these wonderful creatures. Ants are amazing. I watched an ant push another ant all the way along our veranda, which is quite long actually, kept on urging this other ant all the way along the veranda until I got to the end, and They moved across towards some wood, and the one in front thought, I've had enough of this, and it hid behind a bit of wood. So the other one, I'm trying to find it, to no avail. So it just sort of stopped, and the other one scurried up the hill. I thought, good on you. I thought it might be a female, the one who was being pushed. It just, yeah, it's amazing. And carrying the food, as big as they are, you know, for meters. Just amazing, these little animals, these little insects. Cicadas, crickets, 25 kinds of birds. Beautiful, beautiful. We've got one up here, and Peter will show some photographs soon. And it sat in a bottle brush behind our kitchen, and it was there for a number of days, wasn't it? And it would be very noisy, especially in the morning. This is also where we live, Aboriginal land. The Ngadjeri people lived here. And I look out of my window in the mornings, and I'm sitting there with a cup of tea which my beautiful husband has brought me, and I can see Aborigines up there on the hill, because this is their land as well. I can also see our daughter Alexandra, who phoned me this morning, she lives in Auckland, coming down that hill towards me with a smile on her face. Brenda, happy birthday, happy Mother's Day, and would you like to come up and give us a reading? Thank you, Brenda. Island Home by Tim Winton.
This reading, when I first read it, I thought, how wonderful that he should feel so personally involved with his island home. When I was born in 1960, there was about a square kilometre for every person on the island continent. 55 years later, the population has doubled, but density is still exceptionally low. Despite a peopled history of 60,000 years, Australia remains a place with more land than people, more geography than architecture. But it is not and never has been empty. Since people first walked out of Africa and made their way down to this old chunk of Gondwana, when it was not yet so distant from Asia and the rest of the world, it has been explored and inhabited, modified and mythologized, walked and sung. People were chanting and dancing and painting here tens and tens of thousands of years ago, before the advent of the toga and the sandal. This is true antiquity. Few landscapes have been so deeply known, and fewer still have been so lightly inhabited. People learned to live differently here because circumstances were unique. Instead of four seasons, there were five, sometimes six. Water was scarce. The soils were thin and infertile, and the plants and animals were like nothing else on earth. Living here was a specialized affair. Australia hatched and laced with ancient story and human experience, and yet there has always been a lot of space between these gossamer threads of culture. They are strong, but so unifyingly taut as to be hard to distinguish, especially by those who go looking for signs of building or evidence of perennial habitation. Those who become the Aboriginal peoples of this continent were almost always required to live nomadically. Their occupation of many regions was seasonal, even notional. Distant but precious country was held by skeins of song and webs of ritual. So even country that was not physically occupied was never empty. Places were intimately known and culturally vital, but culture rarely imposed itself in concrete terms. Artifacts and constructions were largely ephemeral, and icons required seasonal refreshment. Just as a child was conceived by appearing as an image in a waterhole before a woman became pregnant, culture originated in and deferred to country. 2 centuries after this way of living was interrupted forever, Australia is still a place where there is more landscape than culture. Our island resists the levels of containment and permanent physical presence that prevail on most other continents. It probably always will.
Wasn't that beautifully read? Thank you so much. I'm very happy. Thank you. And into this idyllic setting comes the summer season and fire. I want to read from a book by Bill Gammage, The Biggest Estate on Earth, How Aborigines Made Australia. For countless generations, people have stared into safe fire. The dancing flames mesmerize, the warm glow is a friend. Not so that other fire, heralded by haze, smoke, red lines in the scrub. That fire is implacable. Alive, it roars, races, leaps, kills, devours. People could not have survived such fires in 1788. Had they faced the Black Santa Saturdays and Ash Wednesdays, which white Australia has suffered, most must have died. Any uncontrolled fire menaced, a day's fire might eat a year's food. It was observed in Central Australia by a fellow by the name of Latz. After several very good seasons, the amount of flammable material can build up to such an extent that a single wildfire, initiated in the height of summer, can sweep over huge areas of the desert, destroying everything in its path. When good rains do not follow these fires, the effect on the flora and fauna, and even the soils, can be devastating. If this situation had arisen in the past, it is hard to imagine how Aboriginal people could have survived. This situation rarely arose. People had to prevent it or die. They worked hard to make fire malleable and to confine killer fires to legends and cautionary tales. But a great challenge was a great opportunity. Fires could kill. But fire or no fire could distribute plant communities with the precision of a flame edge. Fire could be an ally. Not so for the fires that we have experienced in the Clare Valley. In fact, the first fire was in 2006. Was started by a friend of ours with an angle grinder. He thought he could control it, but he couldn't. And I can remember him telling me once, we were sitting together, and I said, I don't know why I'm talking to you, because I had sat on our, and we were very naive. That was, we hadn't been in the valley for very long, and we were naive and not prepared for fires as we are now. And I watched it race across the hills, and I watched and I smelt it and I heard it. And I rang Peter and I said, I think you better forget your haircut. I can see fire down from our place. Please come home, because I was there on my own. In fact, the fellow, Damien McKenzie, who built our house, the builder from the valley, actually arrived first. It was his house and he wasn't going to see it go up in flames. So he arrived before Peter did. And the two men sort of walked around and they looked and saw everything, and we were just so naive, Peter, we really were. Someone rang me and said, I've heard that there are fires in your area, and we weren't even listening to the radio. But times have changed. We've experienced other fires down at the bottom of our own property, where someone was teaching his son or grandson to drive a car in stubble. And you don't do that, because the bottom of a car will set the stubble alight. And that's exactly what happened. And there I am, sitting on our wonderful veranda again, with the CFS coming roaring down one of our side roads, with the men still putting on their gear so that they could put out this fire, which had been started by a neighbour. Perhaps the biggest fire was that in the Pinery area. You may have heard about it not so long ago, 2016, I believe. 15, right. Yes. This fire was enormous. Damaged land, houses were lost, two people died. A friend in Tali, who had a little coffee house, sat and watched as the fire encircled her small town. And she thought of her younger daughter who was in Kapunda at school, and the fire was going in that direction. And perhaps also thought of her other daughter who was in Gawler, and the fire was going in that direction as well. After that fire, we drove through blackened paddocks, looked at blackened trees. We looked at two identical houses that were in Templars, which is a very small town en route to Adelaide from where we lived in the Clare Valley. Beautiful homes, rather Dutch in appearance, exactly the same, but one of them was hit by a fireball and it was burnt to the ground. I believe a young family lived in that house. So it's been that area has been cleared away, and now we drive past, there is one house there. Such a memory of what a fire can do. This is where we experience community support. You know, country's wonderful for support and for the people you know. And we went to two meetings. Everybody was there, all of our neighbours, all of the people who lived around. The CFS was there. The people who made sandwiches for the volunteers. The police, the SES, other community groups. It's an amazing experience, you know, when something like this happens, to feel the community care and warmth. Bill Gammage tells us again of how Aborigines actually managed fire in a different way. If you can say, we Europeans actually manage fire. We cope with it. In 1788, most fires were cool. Cool fires burnt most land, and patches were common from rainforest to desert. In midsummer 1802, a valley south of Port Lincoln was recently burned, the old casuarinas remaining. Know those trees? Yes. Besides the general fire, there seem to have been others more partial and more recent. In southeast Queensland, natives had very recently fired the grass of the plain, but as its herbage was generally very young and verdant, only small patches of it had become ignited. Now in Central Australia, although fires were lit wherever sufficient fuel was available, the fires rarely extended over large areas. The effect of traditional burning regimes was to produce a series of small patches of country at different stages of recovery from fire with associated different plant and animal communities. This was almost completely eliminated. This almost completely eliminated the risk of large-scale wildfires, which would have been disastrous for any group attempting to survive in a completely burnt-out area. And one more in East Arnhem Land. As soon as the grass begins to dry in a normal season, often as early as April, the people start to burn it systematically, I love some of these words, in conjunction with organised hunting drives. The grass is not fired at random, but in limited areas, always held under control. The burning of the grass, although it yields much animal food, has the disadvantage of destroying the vines of food plants, and so is carried out with great care until the vegetable harvest is well advanced. It's just so well organized. It's amazing. When I think of some of the fires that we have experienced. Our land was burnt on Ash Wednesday. I wish to finish today with some other words of Tim Winton. Whom I find a delightful writer. Our future is organic and material. This earth is our home, our only home. And if home and family aren't sacred, what else can be? The dirt beneath our feet is sacred. Every other consideration springs from this, and you don't need to be an archaeologist, a botanist or a geologist to know it. Kakadu elder Big Bill Naichi was none of these. He'd been a buffalo hunter, lugerman and mill worker in his younger days. He was the last surviving speaker of the Gagudju language, and in his later life he was an inspirational leader. I'd like to read a poem which I consider, which I think this man wrote. I love it tree because he love me too. He watching me, same as you. Tree, he working with your body, my body. He working with us. While you sleep, he working. Daylight, when you're walking around, he work too. That tree, grass, that all like our father. Dirt, earth. I sleep with this earth. Grass, just like your brother. In my blood, in my arm, this grass. This dirt for us, because we'll be dead. We'll be going this earth. This the story now. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Expanding Horizons for the week.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing UnitarianSA@bigpond.com. please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.